app for your phone. Available at the App Store and Google Play.
It's 2 o'clock.
There's a lot of evidence that the country's and the state's economies are on the mend, but that's affecting different people at different speeds. Arizona's food banks say from their perspective, it still looks like recession.
You hear different indicators in the news of the recovery, how the stock market's recovered, how other indicators have recovered, and yet demand for food remains really, really high.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Ahead on the show, along with our partners from the world, we'll bring you the latest national and international news and keep you up to date on Arizona, including Phoenix's bond rating being downgraded and what it could mean for the city and its economic rise. Could Phoenix turn into Detroit?
And you better watch out for cops, especially if you're drinking and driving.
We're not making it a secret. We're not hiding behind, you know, a tree waiting for you to come out. I mean, it's well publicized.
Those stories and more ahead on the show after a check of this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. More than a million Americans will exhaust their federal unemployment benefits tomorrow. The prospect of another extension remains uncertain as Congress recesses for the holidays. Michigan resident Tammy Hazlett was laid off in June. She was asked what she planned to do after tomorrow.
I'm already pretty frugal. I don't know. I mean, how do you plan when you're earning $320 a week?
Hazlett told WBUR's Here and Now she'll have to find a third part-time job to make up for the money she's about to lose. But she'll keep hoping to find that one job that lets her put her environmental science degree to work, specializing in storm water. Even though federal jobless benefits are ending for many long-term unemployed, states are said to be handling cutoffs differently. A federal judge in New York has upheld the National Security Agency's mass call tracking program. We've got the latest from NPR's Ari Shapiro.
The ACLU brought this case against the government, arguing that mass data collection violates the constitutional right to privacy. Judge William Pauley disagrees, siding with the NSA. He says there's no evidence that the government used phone and email data for any purpose other than investigating and disrupting terrorist attacks. And he notes that the program has executive and congressional oversight. While he says the program is lawful, Judge Pauley writes, the question of whether that program should be conducted is for the other two branches of government to decide. Members of Congress have talked about reining in the NSA, and a presidential panel has recommended scaling back the program. President Obama says he'll reveal his plans in a speech next month. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
The retailer Target confirms that debit card PIN numbers were part of the financial information stolen from millions of its customers. But NPR's Margot Adler reports Target maintains the data safe and secure.
A spokesperson for Target, Molly Snyder, in an email statement said the stolen PIN information was strongly encrypted when it was removed. The cyber attack on Target began the day before Thanksgiving. Information including names, credit card numbers, and expiration dates were stolen from some 40 million customers who shopped at Target between that date and the middle of December. It's considered the second largest data breach in U.S. retail history. A number of lawsuits have already been filed against the retailer for the data breach. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
A prominent pro-Western politician was among at least six people killed today in a car bombing in Beirut, Lebanon. More than 70 people were hurt. The attack comes amid heightened sectarian tensions in that country, which have been fueled by the civil war in neighboring Syria. Before the close, Dow is off 2 points at 16,478. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, giving all profits from Newman's Own to charity and pursuing the common good for over 30 years.
From KJZZ News in Phoenix, I'm Bruce Drummond. The team looking into thousands of reports of child abuse that went ignored says more than half of those cases have been assigned to investigators. From Phoenix, KJZZ's Nick Blumberg has more.
In late November, the director of Child Protective Services parent agency revealed that more than 6,500 calls to a hotline for reporting neglect and abuse were wrongly classified and illegally ignored. Five senior CPS workers have been placed on administrative leave. 3 weeks ago, Governor Jan Brewer named a team to investigate the ignored cases, led by the head of Arizona's Juvenile Corrections Department. Thursday, the team gave the latest report on its progress. It said nearly 3,300 ignored cases have been assigned to child welfare investigators. More than 1,700 children have been checked on in person, and nearly 1,500 other cases have also been responded to. Nick Blumberg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Lowell Observatory's iconic Clark Telescope in Flagstaff is set to experience a much-needed facelift. The instrument is scheduled to close on January 1st as engineers and technicians carefully remove telescope components and repair or replace poorly operating parts. The observatory expects the telescope to reopen in 2015. The renovation project is supported in large part by major donations. A successful crowdsourcing effort also raised significant support, and the observatory is still accepting donations to complete the work. For the past three decades, the Clark Telescope has been a staple of the observatory's outreach program. More than 1 million visitors have seen or looked through the Clark. We should see sunshine for the rest of the afternoon today in Phoenix. It'll be partly cloudy tonight with a low of 45, a few clouds tomorrow, and a high of 69. We've exceeded our forecast high in Phoenix. Right now, under sunny skies, it's 73 degrees.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Healthcare Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The Battle of Okinawa, 1945. History buffs will clearly remember the event and the Japanese island. But if you're of a younger age, chances are you associate Okinawa with a very different historical event, the 1996 gang rape of a schoolgirl by Americans serving at the U.S. military base there. Today, the island's governor approved moving that base, the Marines' Futenma Air Station, after 17 years of dispute. A new base will be built away from dense population areas. The World's Sonia Narang spent several weeks reporting on Okinawa back in 2010 and 2011.
A lot of Okinawans want the base completely off the island, so for them, it's kind of bittersweet. People don't like the fact that it's in a densely populated area that's near schools, near homes, but at the same time, a lot of people on the island were really upset that it was going to move just, you know, north of Ginawan City, which is where the base currently is. So it's really not a move off the island, but more of a relocation to another part of the island, which is less populated, but there's still a lot of vocal dissent.
Well, remind us, Sonia, why the U.S. needs to have a military base somewhere in Japan.
It's a very strategic location for the U.S. It's situated right there near China, near Korea, where, you know, the U.S. needs to have some sort of a defense system. And for the Japanese government, it's also a very strategic location. Right now, there's a lot of tensions with China, with Korea, and for Shinzo Abe's government, Okinawa is literally the best spot to have a strong military and defense force.
I mean, and at the end of World War II, right? I mean, the Japanese, according to the armistice, they were not allowed to have a military. Their defense systems had to be provided by the U.S., correct?
Exactly. So after World War II, they had to dismantle their own military completely. And they do have a self-defense force, but they aren't allowed to, you know, aggressively attack other countries. So they rely on the United States, and the United States then understands, you know, the officials I talked to at Futenma Air Station said, well, we're here to protect the Japanese. We're here to actually serve them and the people. So if anything happens between Japan and China, the U.S. forces are the only ones that can act.
I mean, even though the base won't be moved entirely off the island, this news will probably be some relief to the people who live right next to it right now.
Right, right. I mean, the area where the new base is slated to be constructed is in a remote area. It's a coastal area. It's away from a major city. So the people who live near Futenma Base are, you know, at least happy that the base is moving away from their backyard. But at the same time, you know, a lot of them feel for their neighbors to the north. You know, they feel that their fellow Okinawans who live up north are now going to have to live with these issues.
Now, you mentioned this a second ago, Sonia. I mean, we've been seeing tension between China and Japan in the last couple of months. Is this also about Japan's current leadership trying to consolidate the country's military might in the region? And isn't it odd because they need the U.S. to flex that might?
Yes. So Shinzo Abe has made a lot of strides in not only bolstering the U.S.-Japan relationship, but also trying to improve and expand the Japanese self-defense forces. So, yeah, they need the U.S. support, especially now that, China is becoming a greater threat. They're worried about North Korea, as is most of the world. And so they're really relying on the U.S. armed forces in Japan. And, you know, they really need to make peace with the U.S. And this agreement is one way for them to really show the U.S. that they support what the U.S. is doing in Japan and how the U.S. is protecting them.
The World's Sonia Narang, who spent several weeks reporting from Okinawa, thanks very much for telling us about this.
Thank you, Marco.
You can see Sonia's photos of Okinawa, some of the protests there, and the Marine base. We have a slideshow at PRI.org. Here in the U.S., there's another big story involving the U.S. military. I'm talking about a new law that's now in effect that cracks down on sexual assaults in the military. President Obama took a break from his vacation in Hawaii to sign the bill yesterday. Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas is pleased, to say the least. The Massachusetts Democrat co-authored key provisions in the new law, along with Ohio Republican Mike Turner. Tsongas first became aware of the extent of the problem in 2007 during a hearing of the House Armed Services Committee, on which she serves.
Coincidentally, maybe a month later, I went to a Wounded Warrior luncheon and got to talking with a woman who had been deployed many times to Afghanistan and Iraq, and I asked her if this crime was as prevalent as the hearing would suggest. And she said, "Ma'am, I've never been assaulted, but I am more afraid of my own service members than I am of the enemy." And to protect herself, she always had a knife. She carried a knife in her waistband. So I have to tell you that conversation made this issue very real to me.
That must have changed your perception of the military.
Well, no, I have high regard for the military. We have people who put in their lives at risk to serve our nation. But, you know, the way I look at this crime is it's a betrayal that takes place across many fronts. So if you're a person, male or female, seeking to serve our country, which I give great credit to, especially in times of war, and the experience of war is a life-changing event, the last thing you expect is that you will be assaulted and betrayed by your own. The second betrayal occurs when the chain of command fails to take these crimes seriously and tends to push them under the rug. The third betrayal occurs when either the chain of command or others serving with you retaliate against you for bringing allegations of this crime forward. And then the Uniform Code of Military Justice, again, betrays the victim in many, many ways. So this is an issue in which there are many multifaceted in nature. There is no single bullet to fix it. And Congressman Turner and I, as well as others on the Armed Services Committee and across the Congress, you know, simply seek to address this as we learn new challenges and feel they have to be fixed.
And this bill does take investigations into sexual assault charges out of the chain of command.
It does do that, and most importantly, for the first time, it changes the commander's authority. Commanders previously had the authority to overturn a jury verdict. So if an assailant was found guilty of sexual assault, a commander could overturn that verdict. A commander will no longer be able to do this, and this is the first real significant change to a commander's authority in the area of sexual assault that has taken place in decades.
Congresswoman, is this bill enough? What do you think is left undone?
Well, as I said, it's a discovery process, so we will carefully monitor how these many reforms are implemented. We will carefully monitor their impact, you know, not only on the ways in which this crime is dealt with, but also on the culture of the military, and we will be prepared to take additional steps as needed.
Massachusetts Democrat Nikki Tsongas, who co-authored the bill signed into law yesterday by President Obama, which aims to restrict sexual assault in the military. Thank you very much, Congresswoman.
Thank you, Marco. Happy to talk with you.
There's also an ongoing effort on how to address another kind of trauma in the military. Some in Veterans Affairs are saying that psychological damage from especially devastating war violence, such as the killing of children or seeing friends killed, can wound the soul. They call it moral injury. Susan Kaplan reports.
Serving in Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2004, Army Sergeant First Class Robin Johnson's platoon was running a routine checkpoint, hoping to catch people carrying car bombs or explosives in their vehicles. Suddenly, a car comes out of a side street. Johnson says it speeds up and heads straight towards them.
The window of signaling, shooting to for a warning shot, shooting to disable, and then engaging can be milliseconds. I mean, you have to make that judgment call of, is this a threat?
Johnson's platoon engages. He's one of the first to fire.
Once it was done, it was just a family. You know, mother, father, an infant in the mother's lap, and then two little girls in the back seat.
Johnson relives that day over and over again, often angry at the father.
You know, like, why didn't you just stop? Like, why didn't you stop? You know, was he trying to get down the next side street? Did we scare him? What was going on in his head at that moment? Now this whole family's gone. You know, they got up that morning and they ate breakfast together and they talked and they laughed and they, you know, planned out their day and, you know, and now they're gone.
What makes a warrior a warrior is taking personal responsibility. And when they fail to live up to that enormously high ideal, that's moral injury.
Retired Navy psychiatrist William Nash helped pen the latest Marine and Navy Combat Operational Stress Control Doctrine, basically the mental health Bible for military leaders. Nash says it includes, for the first time, the concept of damage from moral injury within a PTSD diagnosis. And it wasn't easy for therapists
to be asking veteran service members after they come back from a war zone about events where they did things that maybe they were told to do, maybe they had to do, that in context of a crazy counterinsurgency war were the right thing to do, that they now feel were unacceptable, unforgivable.
Nash says the idea, the acknowledgement, and yes, even the words are a tough hurdle for the military. But by acknowledging that moral injury is something unique, the military can work on creating a unique treatment for it. In general, troops suffering from PTSD find themselves anxious or afraid, and that fear can take over their lives. Brett Litz, a psychologist with the VA in Boston, says moral injuries occur less from fear and more from loss, especially, he says, from violent traumatic loss.
These morally injurious experiences are particularly scarring because they're associated with shame and guilt and feeling that you're not entitled to get better and to live a good life, and not something that you can just get back on the horse about. It's not something that's easy to talk about. So loss is a very important and very separate kind of potential harm for service members in war.
The VA has created something called adaptive disclosure therapy. It's relatively short, just 6 sessions. At one point, soldiers are asked to relive their most disturbing experiences, to close their eyes, and imagine they're speaking to an unconditionally loving and non-judging person. Litz says early results from a pilot trial held with Marines at Camp Pendleton in California are encouraging, but the therapy is just the beginning.
Because we're not healing people, we are starting a healing process.
Another problem with moral injury, soldiers don't really like to talk about it. Sergeant First Class Johnson, he's now 34. He served 3 tours in Iraq and 2 in Afghanistan. He says events like the killing of the family in 2004 are chewed over and judged by a public that has no concept of the battlefield. So Johnson talks only to a few people about the worst of what he's seen and done, mostly guys who were there.
I don't think people can possibly understand, like, how much you give up, kind of. Like, you keep going, you keep fighting, but I don't know. It's hard to explain. Like, we joke about it a lot, and we kind of make jokes of it that, you know, we're not human anymore. Like, that humanity's dead in us.
Only a handful of people in the VA and the military push to have the phrase moral injury officially used in diagnosing some forms of PTSD. But the Department of Defense is now conducting a larger clinical trial. Adaptive disclosure advocates argue that the military will need the same kind of courage it takes to fight on the battlefield to find treatment for the kinds of deep psychological wounds service members face today. For The World, I'm Susan Kaplan.
This is The World from Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us on KJZZ 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org.
KJZZ is supported by Chandler Center for the Arts, presenting Dick Van Dyke and the Vantastics January 25th. Moscow Festival Ballet's Swan Lake January 31st and Pat Metheny Unity Group on February 23rd. Tickets at ChandlerCenter.org.
In Valley traffic on the I-17 southbound, there's a report of a disabled vehicle that's blocking the HOV lane at Bethany Home Road. Look for sunshine around the valley today. It's 70 degrees right now in Chandler, 68 in Glendale, 70 degrees in Mesa, and 69 in Scottsdale.
Your news and information station is now on your phone with the newly available KJZZ mobile app. You can read the latest headlines, get podcasts of KJZZ shows, and stream KJZZ all from your smartphone. Download the app for free at the Apple App Store and Google Play.
It's 2:21.
It's the show. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Mark Brody. This afternoon, along with our partners at The World, we're keeping you connected with stories from Phoenix and around the globe. During the winter holiday season, DUI prevention becomes a top priority for law enforcement. Over the past several years, Arizona has put into place increasingly severe punishments for drunken driving. As KJZZ's Nick Blumberg tells us, those measures have helped push down fatality rates, but stopping DUI can be complicated.
As of Monday, about 7,600 law enforcement officers statewide have participated in holiday DUI task forces that started the week of Thanksgiving. Nearly 3,000 people have been arrested.
We don't want to have the holidays marred by a tragic incident related to drinking and driving.
Sergeant Stephen Carbajal is with the Tempe Police Department's Vehicular Crimes Unit. He says his department has participated in DUI task forces going back to the 1980s.
We're not making it a secret. We're not hiding behind, you know, a tree waiting for you to come out. I mean, it's well publicized. At this point, everybody has the information, and we're being forthright about it. If you choose to drink and drive, you're going to get arrested. It's that simple.
Arizona was one of the first states to make ignition interlocks mandatory for first-time DUI offenders. Those interlocks require drivers to blow into something like a breathalyzer before the car will start. Kelly Dupes is with the Arizona chapter of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. That group wants to see interlocks mandatory in all 50 states. Dupes says it's a fair punishment.
What the interlock does is it allows offenders to kind of go about their life, to be able to pick their kids up from school, to go to work, and to do all those things, but to keep the rest of us safe. And we've also learned with the interlock that the recidivism rate is extremely low for folks coming back for that second or third offense.
But while interlocks are seen as effective, some experts say it's hard to pinpoint one piece of the enforcement puzzle that's pushed DUI rates down. University of Portland sociologist Brian Rookie says one of the best methods to date was lowering the blood alcohol content limit from 0.1 to 0.08.
When that law changed, it did correspond to a pretty substantial decrease in alcohol-related fatalities.
Rookie also says things like open container laws, license suspensions, and DUI checkpoints have pushed rates down, but he thinks law enforcement and lawmakers can do more or do things better. For example, Rookie says it's important to distinguish between someone convicted of their first DUI who's learned their lesson
and somebody who hasn't and who's at a great risk to reoffend, and then apply the more severe sanctions, the ignition interlocks, and, you know, couple that with counseling and addiction treatment programs and jail time.
Last year, a little more than 10,000 people died in the U.S. in alcohol-related crashes. Mad says the rate in 1980 was about 45,000. Brian Rookie sees changing community standards as a big part of that.
It's becoming more acceptable to intervene in a situation in which one of your friends or fellow drinkers is planning to drive, and that opens the door for forms of informal social control that can prevent drunk driving without necessarily involving the police.
Put more simply, Mads Kelly Dupes calls it,
surrounding ourselves with folks who help us make better decisions. Our goal really is to have that next generation of designated drivers versus that next generation of drunk drivers.
Nick Blumberg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
As we just heard from Nick, law enforcement agencies are targeting drunk drivers this holiday season, but alcohol isn't the only impairment on officials' minds. Linda Gorman with AAA Arizona cites everything from eating and grooming to texting and surfing the web. She's in favor of anything that gets drivers to keep their minds on the road.
Anything that can, you know, increase the awareness and reduce the risk. We know that there are a couple of things that tend to work and have people curb behaviors. One of those is education, but enforcement is a big help.
Another factor that can play a role is engineering. Andrew Smigelski owns Southwest Traffic Engineering and says planners design your commute by starting with slower speeds and lots of access on residential streets, increasing speeds and limiting access on collector streets, arterials, and then freeways.
On your home street in your neighborhood, you have a lot of driveways. There's quite a bit of places where people can pull out of, in and out of their homes. As you get onto the arterial streets, you start seeing the amount of those driveways go away. And if you're into the old core of the cities, you'll see more driveways because that's the way we used to build. But we knew that the more driveways you have, the more conflicts you get, which drops the safety factors. And that's what we've been trying to get away from here now in current design practices now. So when you get outside the city and you see a Greenway Parkway or a Hayden Road, you'll see that there's fewer and fewer driveways, and there's areas where only you could turn left at a signal. Now, as you get up to a freeway, you can only get on and off a freeway or a highway every mile, sometimes only every two.
There's a lot of talk about how distractions like texting and using cell phones, eating a meal, combing your hair, shaving, whatever, they take your eyes off the road and make things slightly more dangerous, maybe more than slightly dangerous. As an engineer, is there a way that you can kind of account for that, or do you just have to hope that people are smart enough not to do those things?
Well, we try to design for as many things as we can, but a lot of times drivers surprise us with experience that we don't have. And we build safety into the roads. We have what we call a clear zone, and depending on the level of road, a clear zone is an area next to the traveled roadway that if you ran off of the road, you could recover your vehicle, you'd be able to stop in a safe manner. Or if you did hit something like a street light or a street sign, that would buckle in a way that wouldn't go through your car, and it would have a breakaway post. So we do those kinds of things. We try to limit the access, and so we do our best, but it still comes down to, if you're not paying attention, you're texting, your head is down, it's amazing what you miss depending on your speed.
Are there factors in the valley or in the way that valley roadways have been engineered over the years that make it easier or more difficult to try to achieve some of what you're doing?
Well, it's a lot of times when you get into the core areas, whether it's Old Town Scottsdale or in Mesa or in downtown Phoenix, a lot of times these access points are set. There are buildings that are too close to the road, and we're not able to maybe add a bike lane. And so a lot of times the right-of-way makes it a challenge. So a lot of what we're doing in these new types of designs, we're seeing in the outer, in the newer neighborhoods. And when you come back into the core, you saw that the 15th Avenue, 12th Street in Phoenix, they removed the lane in each direction to try to make it safer, and they've had wonderful success there.
Andrew Smigelski owns Southwest Traffic Engineering in Phoenix.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hi, I'm Frankie Esquivel, and I'm horseback riding. It was pretty fun. It was easier than I thought. It was nice and gloomy, cloudy. Looks like it was about to rain, but it didn't. I watched a lot of cowboy movies when I was little, so I always wanted to go horseback riding.
Frankie Esquivel horseback riding at Ponderosa Stables at South Mountain. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. It's The Show. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Mark Brody.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jamie McIntyre. Utility workers continue to put in long hours as they labor to restore power cut during last weekend's ice storm. Michigan, which was the hardest hit, still has more than 50,000 customers without electricity. About the same number are without power in eastern Canada, more than half of them in Toronto. Crews in Maine still have some 12,000 customers in the dark. And Lynette Miller with Maine's Emergency Management Agency says it looks as though more bad weather is on the way.
The utilities have been with us all the way and with the Weather Service, so they are fully aware of what they potentially could be facing. And they still have many, many crews from out of state and from Canada here, and they're just trying to get as much done as possible before the weather.
Miller says right now the biggest threat is carbon monoxide poisoning from improperly vented portable gasoline generators. The storm has been blamed for 17 deaths in the U.S. and 10 in Canada. 1.3 million people will see their unemployment benefits end as of tomorrow. Democrats and a handful of Republicans are calling for an extension of the program. House Speaker John Boehner has said he would entertain an extension, but that would have to be paid for with spending cuts elsewhere in the budget. NPR's Tamara Keith brings us up to date.
Congress failed to extend the emergency federal unemployment insurance program before leaving town for the holidays. This means anyone who has been out of work and getting benefits for more than 6 months will see their weekly checks stop abruptly. Although the unemployment rate has steadily fallen, long-term unemployment remains a persistent problem, with more than 4 million people unemployed for more than 6 months. Advocates point out that without congressional action, another 73,000 people will lose benefits each week. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street today, stocks fell, but just slightly. The Dow was down 1 point to 16,478. The S&P lost a fraction. NASDAQ dropped 10. This is NPR.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations and communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Healthcare Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. 2013 was the year the city of Detroit filed for bankruptcy, the largest U.S. city ever to do so. And few places in Detroit symbolize the decay of America's Motor City so fully as the old abandoned Packard Auto Plant. It's been sitting in ruins for more than five decades, a 40-acre crumbling disaster zone. But that doesn't seem to faze the site's new owner, Peru-based Spanish developer Fernando Palazuelo. He bought the plant recently at auction. Reporter Annie Murphy, with our partners at Radio Ambulante, spoke with the developer in the Peruvian capital, Lima.
When I meet Fernando Palazuelo, he's dressed in cargo pants, loafers, and a button-down shirt. It's the sort of outfit a 20-year-old might wear to a summer internship. But Palazuelo is one of the largest property owners in downtown Lima. And he never dreamed he'd find historic real estate for cheaper than what he paid here, back before Peru's economic boom.
When I began to buy in Lima, I'm paying $100 per square meter, when in Spain it was $10,000 or $12,000.
But that was also before Detroit went bankrupt and Palazuelo bought the old Packard plant.
In Detroit, I am paying $1.3 per square meter, already constructed.
Palazuelo's 58. As a young man, he served in the Spanish Foreign Legion in North Africa. And when he got out, he started buying and restoring old buildings in Spain. He says he applies what he learned in the armed forces to real estate.
So I think like a military, no? So one of the gold rules is adapt yourself to the landscape.
This, says Palazuelo, is how he managed to buy and refurbish buildings in Madrid, Barcelona, Bilbao, and Mallorca. And until 5 or 6 years ago, he never dreamed of leaving Spain.
I was living in the palace in Mallorca, 2,000 square meters with frescoes and a garden. I mean, the most fantastic house you can ever think, with a collection of old Ferraris. And I thought, finally, well, I've done it, no?
Then came the 2008 financial crisis. Palazuelo lost everything.
I was forced to file for bankruptcy in Europe, in Madrid, Barcelona. I sold my Ferrari collection, and I sold my house in Barcelona and in Mallorca. I left my family with little money, and I told them I have to move.
And he came here, to Lima. Property was still cheap, but after decades of terrorism and government corruption, Lima's historic downtown was in really bad shape. Yet Palazuelo saw opportunity. The only issue was that he had no money. He was able to persuade building owners to let him buy entirely on credit. The next thing, he says, was finding tenants.
I went to Europe, I went to the States, I went to Mexico, and in the middle of the crisis, with Lehman Brothers collapsing and all the Spanish saving banks collapsing, I mean, I was telling them, move your office to Peru. Bring your departments out of the expensive countries. So I was able to create in 6 years 15,000 new jobs in the historical center and fill all my buildings.
And thanks to Peru's booming economy, all those properties he bought at $100 a square meter are now valued at between $1,800 and $2,000 per meter. A few months ago, Palazuelo was reading the newspaper and saw that Detroit was filing for bankruptcy.
I thought, my God, what happens with Detroit, no? So during 1 month, I was reading information and thinking about opening an office there, no?
At the end of August, he flew there. His first stop was the old Packard plant. He couldn't get a cab driver to go to the neighborhood, so he walked. And he fell in love with the site. After, he went to the Wayne County Treasurer's office, which he says was filled with people trying to stop foreclosures.
I never thought that in the States you could see something like Detroit in August. I mean, it was really like a war, no?
Palazuelo waited hours to talk to someone and finally convinced them that he was serious and wanted to buy the Packard plant. It ended up costing him just over $400,000. He plans to overhaul the whole thing, which he says will take at least another $350 million, and to turn it into a mixed-use space with light industry and tech companies, artist studios, and apartments. He himself hopes to move in for his birthday on April 9th. According to Palazuelo, his whole story is about knowing how to adapt to change.
I mean, we all thought Peru, Bolivia, third-class countries. How somebody from Europe living in a high standard can collapse and then come here to a third-class country, recover himself, and help Detroit with the knowledge and the people from Peru.
Palazuelo says he'll be investing a lot of resources from Peru, from Lima-based architects to money generated by his projects here in Detroit. For Rembrandt in the World, I'm Annie Murphy in Lima.
As this year draws to a close, we're revisiting some of the biggest stories we've covered. Today, the attack on the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi, Kenya. That was back in September. 67 people died and more than 200 were injured. You'll remember the Islamist group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the siege, but the investigation into exactly what happened has been marred by confusion. So where are things at right now? Well, during the siege, we spoke with Kenyan journalist Laura Walubengo, and she's with us again now. Before we dig into the investigation, what's happening at the mall now, Laura? Was it open for Christmas shopping, or are there parts of it still being rebuilt?
The mall is completely shut off. The access road to the mall was blocked on one side for about 2 months, and then they opened it up, and now at least you can pass through outside the mall, but the mall is completely shut. They've put some iron sheets outside, so you can't actually see in the mall. The Nairobi governor, Evans Kidero, has set up this committee to come up with some kind of recovery strategy, and they're supposed to touch base early next year.
But is the long-term plan to rebuild the Westgate Shopping Center?
Absolutely. The long-term plan is to rebuild. What they're trying to do, actually, with this committee is to reassure investors that any losses that they may have in the country will be protected by the government, or the government will be involved actively in trying to make sure that any economic losses suffered by any businesses are, you know, recovered.
Apparently, I gather other shopping malls in Nairobi have beefed up their security since the attack. I guess there's a fear that malls are now a target for extremists.
What they've done is not only the malls have had their security beefed up, but we've had places, even churches, are beefing up their security. So any car going in, they'll check even up until your engine to make sure that everything is safe and sound. In some places, they actually ask you to step out so they can check under the car seat and on the seat. It is a common sight all across Nairobi.
Laura, when the attack happened, there were so many questions at the time about the attackers, how many there were, the response by the Nairobi police and military, including some charges that they were looting shops during the siege. Unpack for us what we know for sure right now.
Yes, four of the attackers have been arrested. During the time of the charge, one of the inspectors was trying to have an affidavit passed in court where they said that another four suspects died at the mall, but the court rejected that because there wasn't enough evidence. So there is actually a lot of mystery surrounding the people who perpetrated the attack.
The New York Police Department also came in to assist the Kenyan authorities with the investigation, and some of the reports I've been reading suggest the NYPD and the Kenyans don't see eye to eye on the investigation.
It's quite a bad situation. Because of the ties that the U.S. government and the Kenyan government have, the U.S. government will not actually go ahead and say, look, this is what we found out. And the Kenyan government will stick to their story. So right now the story is that there are only four suspects. The others who managed to flee are being looked for. As to whether the army actually blew up part of the Westgate Mall as they were trying to find these suspects is still up in the air. The police are actually flatly denying it. One of the biggest issues that came out of that is the fact that some of the army soldiers were involved in looting. There were a lot of security officers who were caught on camera looting from some of the several stores. And there was also the questions raised of, let's say, a jewelry store. Once jewelry store is fully packed with all these items, and then after the siege, there's like a quarter of the goods that they have on display actually there. And the question is raised, like, see, these Al-Shabaab guys didn't actually look like they wanted to steal anything. So who could have taken this? And those are some of the biggest questions that came out of there, because we're like, okay, we lauded the security officers for protecting us, but why can't they own up to the fact that some of the officers were involved in looting? The government still flatly denies that anybody was involved.
How have relations between Somalis and Kenyans in Nairobi changed since this attack? Are people more suspicious, or does life go on as normal?
People are definitely more suspicious. I mean, if you look at all the families that were affected by the Westgate incident, a lot of people are suspicious. And there have been incidents of fighting here and there, but nothing too dramatic, fortunately. So there is a kind of wariness, but people are trying to keep to themselves and really look at who their neighbors are. And I do believe a lot of policemen have been receiving tip-offs from members of the public as a result of this Westgate attack and the wariness that it has produced amongst the Kenyans against the Somalis.
How's it changed your own life, Laura?
I missed the mall because my office used to be near there, and it was actually one of the better malls that we had in Nairobi. It was kind of like a landmark for the city because it meant so many things and there were so many things to see in there. And personally, I like the fact that I see a lot of security in hotels and in different malls and in churches. It makes me feel a bit more secure. But it also have developed a little mistrust for the new government, personally.
Kenyan journalist Laura Walubengo speaking with us from Nairobi. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
When Typhoon Haiyan smashed into the Philippine city of Tacloban last month, almost every form of communication with the outside world was knocked out. But there was one that was still working. The World's Leo Hornack tells us about the shortwave radio network that helps survivors get the word out to their loved ones.
0947.
That was a recording of some of the very first voices out of Tacloban after the disaster. And they were made possible by a network of amateur radio enthusiasts across the Philippines.
My name is Ramon Ankilan. I am the Vice Chief Operating Officer of the Philippine Amateur Radio Association.
What is the number of Mario?
Here's what we did. In the Philippines, we implement a system called HAM Emergency Radio Operation. So it's the acronym is a little, you know, highfalutin. We call it HERO.
Raymond's HERO network of amateur radio geeks and enthusiasts worked more or less when everything else had failed. You see, with a shortwave radio kit, you don't need that much to start broadcasting.
With just a simple piece of wire, we hook up the radio and using a 12-volt battery from the car, we're up on air.
Raymond is based in Manila, but when the typhoon hit, he was listening out for one person in particular, his friend Nathan Ian Miguel, a ham radio enthusiast in Tacloban. Here he is on Skype.
When the wind and rain abated, I immediately went outside with my radio set.
The most important thing that we heard was when Nathan finally came up right after the storm passed Tacloban, he transmitted saying that the U5A okay on frequency, and we said, whoa, Nathan is here. We're so happy.
Nathan and other volunteers made their way through the wreckage to Tacloban City Hall, where they set up a makeshift radio station.
Because there was no communication going out of Tacloban or available, a long queue formed at the side of the station of Nathan. It was more than 100 people queuing. We were handling something like 200 plus messages a day.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. It's not a big deal, actually. It's not a big deal. What is important is that we're able to send all those messages and inform the relatives and friends that they're okay.
7155. Mama and Papa and family, okay.
Mama and Papa and family are okay.
Roger, sir.
Roger, Roger.
But not all of the messages were good news.
There are also messages that really drained us. Messages that somebody died.
What was the first message you sent from the shortwave station? Do you remember?
The first message that we sent when we went on air, please send buddy bugs. Please send buddy bugs.
For the HERO team in Manila, passing on messages to relatives carried its own responsibilities.
You know, there's that uncertainty. For example, the message would continue and said, but we don't have our house anymore. I mean, how can you handle that kind of message? You just tell it to the other guy as normal tone as possible, but you also try to control the swell of emotion inside you.
Some people have said that this kind of action is the action of a hero. Do you regard yourself as a hero?
Of course not. Then what I did is just only a matter of procedure. We put up our antenna system, fire up our radio, then do the thing.
When everything else is not available, then we're the only ones left. Amateur radio.
For the world, I'm Leo Hornack.
List Omania up next here on The World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at lookout.com.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KJZZ 91.5 FM.
KJZZ is supported by eHealth 4AZ. eHealth tools help coordinate care by securely sharing patient information among doctors and nurses. You can learn more about how these tools can lead to improved care at eHealth4AZ.org.
Stay with us for All Things Considered coming up at 3. A federal judge in New York ruled today that the National Security Agency's huge collection of telephone data is legal. And America's oil and natural gas sector is on a hiring binge as it races to keep up with the boom in domestic production. All Things Considered starts in about 10 minutes on KJZZ.
Did you know the state of Arizona offers three tax credit programs and you can participate in all three to receive a dollar-for-dollar credit on your state taxes? KJZZ's Spot 127 Youth Media Center qualifies for the Working Poor Tax Credit. You can learn more about this tax deduction at spot127.org.
It's the show. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Mark Brody.
The period leading up to Thanksgiving through New Year's tends to be a busy one for food banks, both in terms of donations coming in and the need for food. Brian Simpson with the Association of Arizona Food Banks says the group's member food banks haven't really seen a slowdown this year from the past few holiday seasons.
They were busy, to put it mildly, a long, constant stream of demand, and that's really been building up for the last couple years and sort of culminating with where we are now. It's interesting, you hear different indicators in the news of the recovery, how the stock market's recovered, how other indicators have recovered, and yet demand for food remains really, really high.
What do you make of the disparity between some of the good economic news that you talked about and also this high demand?
Well, I think a lot of it is the folks that are visiting food banks, the folks that are receiving SNAP benefits, food stamp benefits. You know, those guys are going to be the last to really feel any sort of recovery as the economy continues to improve. And so while, you know, it's improved for some folks and it's improved for some industries and sectors, you know, for the folks at the bottom that are still struggling to get by, find work, or relying on part-time work, the recovery really hasn't hit for them. And so because of that, it looks like if you were to go into a food bank that we were right in the middle of the worst of the recession today.
Do the food banks have enough food to feed all the people who are coming to them?
For the most part, they do. You know, they have done really yeoman's work in strategic planning and leveraging partnerships with food manufacturers, distributors, both locally and nationally, collaborating and working together to make that happen. So for the most part, yes, they do have enough food. Are they giving out a little bit less food per visit than maybe that they were in the past? Yeah, I think that's happening.
With reports of the economy getting better, do you find that folks maybe think that things are getting better than they perhaps are for some people, and maybe the donation levels drop off and you have to work a little bit harder to meet the needs?
I think there's probably some of that. Certainly, if you just consume a lot of media and you look around, I think it's easy for someone to arrive to the conclusion that it's really two different pictures are being painted. You know, on one hand, the economy's recovering, more jobs are being created, and then, you know, you talk to the food banks and, you know, it's not, you know, that rosy of a story. And so I think that does sort of contribute to some donor fatigue or at least some cognitive dissonance where people say, well, gee, I thought things were getting better. And, it doesn't seem like things are getting better. I think the important thing for people to realize is that things are getting better, but it's just going to take some time.
So what's your forecast for 2014?
I think right now we're cautiously optimistic that things will get a little bit better. The way we look at it is maybe we're at the top of that plateau and we seem to be holding steady. Hunger numbers did not increase this year. Enrollments in the food stamp program here in Arizona did not increase this year. So, you know, we're hoping that maybe we're at that tipping point, that now as the economy seems to be improving and some other things are starting to look good, that maybe we'll see, start to see a decrease in need, a decrease in demand. But, of course, a lot of that, you know, remains contingent on a lot of things that are somewhat outside of our control.
Brian Simpson with the Association of Arizona Food Banks. Brian, thanks.
You're welcome.
Last Friday on the show, we talked with the City of Glendale's finance director about decisions the City Council was going to have to make pretty quickly to keep its economic troubles from getting worse. But what about Phoenix? Standard & Poor's, the large international credit rating agency, dropped the city's bond rating from the best, AAA, to AA+. Dennis Hoffman, director of the Seidman Research Institute at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business, says the rating is meant to help lenders assess the risk of various cities and states.
S&P has detected in the city of Phoenix, in their estimation, a slightly higher risk as a result of some of the recent activities in the state of Arizona and the city of Phoenix with respect to economic conditions. And then they've compared that with the ongoing debt obligations of the city. And they're sending a signal to the marketplace that the city of Phoenix is slightly more risky, in their opinion, than it was historically.
Dennis, you're from Michigan. Glendale's been compared to Detroit. Should people start worrying about Phoenix's parallels to Detroit?
And I do want to make a clear line of demarcation between the Detroit experience and, frankly, almost every other city in the nation, and certainly Phoenix. Phoenix is not the city of Detroit. Detroit papered over its problems for decades. And so should, you know, the city of Phoenix continue for decades trying to solve every problem it has by borrowing more, then it might, I guess, conceivably, arithmetically, find itself in a situation like the city of Detroit. But we are decades away and major policy attitudes away from being like the city of Detroit.
Perception can become reality. So will the S&P downgrade bring a negative perception back to Phoenix and keep people from moving here, even as the city's economy finally seems to be bouncing back?
There's data suggesting that folks are feeling better about their existing housing situation. More and more are retiring. Moving freeze, if you would, nationwide, has really been at the root of a lot of the challenges that Metro Phoenix has faced over the last 5 years. People are not moving nationally at anywhere near the rate they did for most of the history of our state and the Phoenix metro area. And we've been the beneficiary, of course, of much of that net in-migration. People will move to Phoenix for reasons of lifestyle, employment opportunity, the same type of reasons that they moved to this state for decades. You know, I just don't see a grade change in the S&P's ratings really going to deter that. Let's face it, the highest rating didn't encourage them to move here over the last 5 years. Mm. I don't think one notch down is going to deter them.
Economist Dennis Hoffman of the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. It was one of the most unique Army regiments in Arizona. The group served in the state for several decades, but its lengthy service wasn't recognized until the 1960s. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez takes us back in time in Arizona history.
In the late 1860s, a cavalry of soldiers was created to build forts, roads, and maintain the peace between white settlers and the native Indians in the Southwest. Two decades later, they were stationed throughout Arizona, including Forts Verde, Whipple, and Apache. Did you know the 10th Cavalry Buffalo Soldiers was the first U.S. African American military unit in Arizona?
They had the same pay and the same duties as any other soldier of the time, but often they had more than one enemy.
John Langelier is director of the Charlotte Hall Museum in Prescott and is the author of numerous U.S. military history books.
They had racism to fight, as well as, say, border raiders or bandits or American Indian tribal groups who were fighting for their own survival and freedom.
Langelier says Buffalo soldiers were among the most committed men in the military. While white soldiers were deserting their units by droves, Buffalo soldiers were re-enlisting and volunteering.
Black soldiers didn't look at this as just a job of work. It was a profession in arms, and so they really took pride in their uniform.
The name Buffalo Soldiers began to surface in newspaper stories in the late 1880s, in papers like the Arizona Republican. But the all-black cavalry unit's military service and nickname didn't gain momentum until the 1960s, during the Civil Rights Movement. Bruce Dingus is with the Arizona Historical Society in Tucson. He says there are several stories as to how these soldiers got its nickname, Buffalo Soldiers.
The two explanations are
One, that it was because their hair resembled the fur on the head of a buffalo. And the other explanation is that it was a term of respect because they were strong and sturdy like the buffalo. But nobody knows exactly why.
Buffalo soldiers fought in several battles, including the Spanish-American War, along with the famous Rough Riders and future President Theodore Roosevelt. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
The show was produced this week by John Hoban, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, with help from Tiara Vian, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer and Julie Levin make up our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias, our news director, Peter O'Dowd. I'm Steve Goldstein for Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZ.